This episode will be in English, right after the German intro.
Hey, kurze Info von uns. Wir sehen, dass die meisten von euch immer wieder hierher zurückkommen und bei Money Matters reinhören. Und es freut uns mega, aber aus irgendeinem Grund haben die wenigsten von euch den Podcast tatsächlich abonniert.
Also, falls ihr nichts mehr verpassen wollt, dann klickt doch einfach auf Abonnieren. So könnt ihr auf dem Laufenden bleiben, sobald eine neue Folge online geht. Danke, dass ihr dabei seid.
We are not dealing with, you know, this case for my pencils. A home is sacred and has to be treated like that.
Money Matters, der Podcast über eine zukunftsfähige Finanzpolitik.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge Money Matters. Ganz schön, dass ihr wieder dabei seid. Wir werden diese Folge auf Englisch aufnehmen, weil das die Sprache ist, in der unser Gast mit uns kommunizieren kann. Und wir laden euch eine Version mit deutschen Untertiteln auf YouTube hoch. So, it's great to have you. Welcome to all the English speakers. My name is Annalena Kümpel. I'm in this podcast because I'm a person with an average level of political knowledge and interest. And as always, by my side is Rasmus Andresen.
Hi, I'm a member of the European Parliament for the Greens and I'm from Northern Germany working on economic and financial stuff in the European Parliament. The right to housing is increasingly being undermined worldwide. More and more investors are dominating the housing market, speculating on real estate. And the consequence of this is that rents are rising and housing is getting more and more expensive for many people. Housing is one of the most pressing issues in the European Union. More and more investors are dominating the housing market, speculating on real estate, and as a result, rents are rising and housing is getting more and more expensive. Now the question is what politics should do about it, and that is what we want to discuss today.
In Europe, there are already some approaches to counteract that development. For example, in the end of 2024, the European Parliament has created a special committee for housing, and we will dive into that topic later.
We will discuss this together with an excellent expert. This time, it's Leilani Faha, the global director of The Shift.
Welcome, Leilani. It's good to have you.
It is such a pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. Leilani, you're currently working with The Shift, which is a global platform advocating for the right to housing. What does your work at The Shift look like? What are your main priorities? How do you operate? Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so we work with sort of three different groups, I would say. We're really keen to try to hold actors accountable for their violations of the right to housing or for their undermining of the right to housing. And so who are those actors? So we have governments and all levels of government. And it's the sad truth that I have yet to meet a government that is really implementing the right to housing across the board. So it's all governments, and we're really looking at government activity and trying to encourage them to understand what their human rights obligations are and to start implementing them. We do a lot of work at the city level, particularly around homelessness, because it's such an egregious violation of the right to housing. But of course, very concerned about the financialization or uber commodification of housing as well, and the way in which government policies interact and legislation interact with that. We are also turning our attention increasingly to the private sector, to investors in housing. And I'm sure we're going to talk about that group a lot today, as well as looking at rights holders themselves. So the people who are struggling, tenants, people living in inadequate housing, people whose housing costs are way too expensive and increasing all the time, and trying to, one, understand their realities and reflect those realities back to the other actors I talked about, but also to learn from them what policy changes are necessary, what are they advocating for, so that we can incorporate that into our work. We do a lot of standard setting at the shift. So by that, I mean trying to take human rights standards and make them easily accessible and understood by everyone, whether it's governments or dwellers, tenants, etc. Because I think human rights are misunderstood. And so I think a lot of people think they're complicated or unrealistic, a vision, a goal, but not something practical. And so we're trying to make it clear that human rights mean something and they're very practical and they can be used by both governments and tenants alike.
Mm-hmm. So you're kind of lobbying for people who need to be housed?
Some people are already housed. Mm-hmm. And so we are really working to keep people housed and to help those who are not housed to secure dignified housing. That's the ultimate goal, yes. But it's very important to focus on the preservation of existing decent housing, because it is slipping away before our eyes.
We experienced that in Germany too, but I understand that you work internationally, right?
Yes, we do work internationally. We opened our doors, the shift, in 2020 at the very beginning of the pandemic, which made it quite difficult to really feel global. I was stuck in my basement office in Ottawa, Canada. We had a colleague in London and a colleague in Geneva. So we did have some, you know, international vibe, but you know what it was like in those lockdown days. So we ended up spending a lot of our first years in Canada, doing work in Canada. Of course, some of the actors we're going to talk about today, the institutional investors, are global. So they are in Canada and they are in Germany and they are in Netherlands and they are in the United States. Yeah. So in that way, we started quite locally and we've been growing globally. We have hopefully an interesting project coming up in South Africa, for example. I've started to do more work in the United States. And of course, we have a big European project now.
You have a history with the United Nations from, I think, 2014 to 2020. You served as a special rapporteur on the right for housing. How was the transition? So what is different in your work for the shift than it was for the United Nations?
Well, when you're a United Nations special rapporteur, you have an incredible platform from which to work. I mean, you are recognized as having been appointed by governments from around the world as an expert in a particular area. And so, you know, the doors, I can't say they were flung open, but certainly doors open in certain ways that's more difficult when you're running an NGO. That's for sure. The world is your audience. The world is your stage when you're a rapporteur. And so in that way, things have changed a little bit. Although because I was rapporteur, I think a lot of doors still remain quite wide open for me. So I'm very lucky at the shift. It puts us in a very unique position. Access to the world was easier. Of course, it was pre-COVID time. So, you know, I had free access to the world. I traveled the world. I went to every region of the world, north, south, east, and west. I met with hundreds and hundreds of people living in all kinds of housing, mostly precarious housing and homelessness, from renters to, you know, people who are living in informal settlements to people who are living in the streets. And so, you know, I say I have probably been into more homes than most people and certainly more homes around the world than most people, which gives you and has given me a very intimate understanding of how important home is to human well-being, to family life, to mental and physical health, to security, to one's ability to participate in democracy, right? If you have stable housing and you're not worried about home it opens so many more doors for you. If you're constantly under threat and worrying, it undermines so much of your well-being and your ability to really participate in your communities. So I feel the rapporteurship gave me this vantage, this viewpoint that was so privileged. I feel I have a responsibility to carry that forward, even though I'm no longer the rapporteur, to make it very clear to governments and investors and others in the housing sector that we are not dealing with, you know, this case for my pencils. A home is sacred and has to be treated like that.
And you can overlook the last 10 years. And how did the situation of housing changed? And is there anything that remained the same? Did things change for the better, for the worse?
There has been some change. The changes all come from the ground, from grassroots movements, from tenants who are organizing, and a few politicians who are listening. And there are some politicians who are listening and who do care deeply about this issue. So I'm starting to see those politicians emerge more and more, which is amazing and absolutely necessary to this situation. Tenants are mobilizing as well in greater numbers, staging more protests, taking legal action, organizing themselves, organizing across borders now. I'm starting to see that emerge, including at the Shift. We've brought together tenants from all across the world to talk about this, what it's like living under a financialized model. We've seen, of course, in Spain and Germany, real mobilization of tenants. And as I said, politicians are listening, particularly in Spain and some politicians in Germany, for sure. where I'm not seeing enough change is in the housing sector itself. The financialized model remains very strong and intact. Even as legislative measures are starting to be introduced, it's still very strong. It's part of the culture and fabric of the housing sector. I'm seeing housing costs continue to escalate, and I'm seeing homelessness continue to escalate. I'm seeing evictions continue to be used as a vehicle for increasing housing costs, right? You move tenants out, you move new tenants in at an increased rate of housing. I'm still seeing an emphasis on mortgage securitization, which is, it's a complicated concept, and maybe we don't want to go there, but just to say that it invites in investors into our homes, in single-family homes in particular, which, again, allows this culture to unfold and to really be rooted in our economic system. So there's still so much work to be done. But for sure, I take a lot of optimism from the grassroots groups that are making changes and those politicians who are listening.
I would like to go a little bit more in depth on the financialization of housing topic. I mean, you mentioned a bit how you would describe this phenomenon. You did that like just some seconds ago, but maybe you could like describe a little bit more what kind of developments do you see in both European countries, maybe also the US or other parts of the world. And also, I mean, you said that like you don't see any kind of huge development there. The problem is had been there for a long time and is still there. But maybe you could describe how you see the situation right now, also with some examples.
So there are different definitions of financialization. I'll tell you the one that we use at the Shift. We generally are talking about a phenomenon that occurred in the aftermath, at the beginnings of and the aftermath of the global financial crisis. Some people call it the Great Economic Recession. And why we use that date is because it was at that time when some of the biggest funds, private equity firms, asset management firms, insurance companies, and even banks got involved in housing in a different way. And part of what made it so different was the financial tools they created to get engaged in housing. For example, securitizing debt, bringing debt all together under one umbrella, and then being able to buy, for example, 40,000 homes in the United States all at once, you know, just like with the snap of a finger. Invitation Homes and Blackstone did that. The unprecedented amount of money that went into housing at that time. I mean, we can say housing has been commodified for a long time. Mortgages are a form of, it's a commodity. So that's why we date it after. We're not at the shift. We're not talking about just regular commodification. We're talking about these new financial tools and the new actors and the unprecedented money that went into housing, plus the business model. The business model is very clear. It is a drive to buy cheap, a drive, and buying cheap means buying where people are able to afford their rents, right? We have to remember that. They buy affordable housing. They do some modest changes. They call them upgrades. And then they sell the property or they benefit from an increased valuation of the property. And that's the business model that is so deeply concerning, the drive to increase the value of the property, because that's never ending, it seems. Saskia Sassen, the sociologist, said in the film Push that she thought maybe that we would reach a stasis, that it would stop at some point. Mm-hmm. And here we are in 2025, and they are still squeezing profits out of every square meter of property and increasing that valuation of property. And so that's how we describe financialization. One of the things that is very interesting about Europe that is not talked about enough, I think, is, you know, it is predominantly American funds that are owning and financializing multifamily apartment buildings in Europe. It's a huge percentage coming from United States-based companies. And I think that's something that Europeans need to really reckon with, really, you know, think through. Do you want European cities to be owned by American funds? And, you know, we look right now, we're on the eve of the inauguration of President Trump. Europe is shaking, right? Shaking, not happy with some of the signals from the Trump administration. So, okay. And yet it's okay to invite in American funds into your housing sector, this sacred place. I really think Europeans need to be having that conversation. I mean, what differentiates a lot of European societies from North American societies is the social welfare state. And I'm not saying it's completely intact in Europe. By no means. I know it's eroding in Europe too, but it remains more intact in Europe. I know because I'm North American. It remains more intact in Europe than it does in North America. And this is something you should be protecting with as Europeans with all of your tools. Yeah. And so I think that's something that we really need to think through in the European context. Who is owning these buildings and what is the impact on families? Yes. On communities? Yes. But on Europe as a region?
I think it's an interesting aspect also linked to the question of European sovereignty. We are discussing a lot when it comes to security and so on, climate, but also having this in mind, I think is quite interesting. I would like to ask a little bit more on if you see some developments in some countries, some regions of the world, like going against this trend and, for example, with public measures and so on. Is there something to learn from others, or do you see the same kind of problem in all of the regions, and or do you think there is something, we can also maybe learn a little bit about?
Yeah. There aren't many examples from around the world that are really good across the board. You know, so you see movement, legislative movement in different places, like a little legislation here, a little legislation there, that's good. But I don't see a system that's really tackling this. I guess Singapore is an example of a state that's quite interventionist. And they, you know, have adopted some pretty aggressive moves when they see that the speculative housing market is getting hotter. They, for example, will increase taxes quite dramatically for second, third, fourth, et cetera, ownership. You know, so if you own one unit, you pay a certain rate of tax. But if you own two, three, four, it escalates quite dramatically. They've used that to some good effect. But, you know, Singapore is a very particular housing market. They have a huge percentage of people living in state-owned or state-subsidized homes. So, you know, it's quite peculiar. You know, the president of Spain just recently said that he would like to see a ban on foreign owners. He then took some steps back and said, I guess he wanted to limit foreign ownership. You know, so we've done that in Canada. It didn't have much impact. Because those sorts of policies, first of all, can be quite xenophobic, let's say that. But in addition, you have to really understand your market. Is there a saturation of foreign ownership? Is that what's causing the increase in housing costs and the unavailability of housing? And are U.S. funds included in foreign ownership, for example? Well, they're mostly not, right? When a government says we want to exclude foreign owners, New Zealand did it as well, and it didn't have an impact. They're talking about, you know, the individual of ultra high net worth who's from China or India or Malaysia who comes and buys a property, or the Arab Gulf states, et cetera. But they rarely talk about U.S. funds as being foreign ownership, because these funds set up domestic companies, right, to do the purchasing. You know, so I've seen some vacant home taxes that have worked in Vancouver. They have a vacant home tax. What I like about it is the money that is derived from the tax goes right into back into affordable housing. So it's a tied tax, which I think can work quite effectively. Mm-hmm. And they really did have a vacant property issue. I do think the regulation, and I know Europe has been, the European Union has been looking at and has new regulations around short-term rentals and trying to make that industry more transparent and accountable to some degree. I think that's important. I don't know that the measures of transparency are enough. But you see, we have to view this as a whole. I view the speculation and the investment in short-term rentals as part of this financialized model, right? Because the idea is that you can turn homes into a financial investment. It's mm-hmm. It's exactly the same as a financialized model. It's, you know, squeezing more profits out of square meters over a shorter period of time, right? Over one night instead of over a month. It's like that. And so those are important moves, but they're not strong enough. What I find is generally governments aren't leading. It's still the investors who lead. I mean, you know, they're all sitting in Davos as we speak. And You know, what conversations are they having? No one even talks about where the wealth of these people is derived when we're looking at Davos. Like, most of them have real estate holdings, and a lot of the wealth is derived from residential real estate. No one even talks about that. And so I feel like and look at the Trump inauguration, who was standing behind President Trump, the big tech billionaires, the Davos men, yeah? And so, you know, I still think governments aren't leading enough. I think we need to see way more government interventions to really say, hey, we've signed on to a whole bunch of international treaties that recognize housing as a fundamental human right, and we're going to do everything we can to defend that right. We are so far away from that. But I mean, I think we could have a bigger conversation about how far away we are from the implementation of human rights. Generally, if you look globally, there's a lot going on that shows human rights don't have much currency in the moment.
We're going to get back to your ideas, what governments could do. But you also mentioned that there are new developments on the EU level. And we have Rasmus here, who is a part of the European Union. Can you give us a brief introduction what is happening on EU level at the moment?
Yeah, sure. I think that, I mean, that's also one of the reasons for why we invited you to discuss this, that housing is like one of the most precious issues right now also here in Europe. And what we can see right now, we are at the beginning of the new term of the EU Commission and the European Parliament elections back in June last year, that housing is like one of the topics like most people, politicians in Brussels are talking about. So this means that we are ended up by getting a commissioner in the EU Commission, which will be responsible for housing. It's the first time like in history of the European Union that there will be like one commissioner responsible for housing. In the parliament, we just voted on a special committee on housing. So there will be like one committee dealing with different aspects of the housing crisis in the EU. And things are starting to move, right? And I think that one of the reasons for why this is the case is that we can see some of the developments you also already described in close to all of the European countries. And the situation is made different on like how much social housing do we have, how our definitions are, and so on. But I think one thing like we have in common, and this is also this trend of financialization of the housing sector, higher rents for many people, especially in the bigger cities, but also in rural areas, connected with a lot of problems. And this is why, both the Commission and also the Parliament, like, is starting to work a little bit more intense on this. And of course, also because of public pressure, we could see in many countries in Europe a lot of citizens raising their concerns and initiatives, like here in Berlin, where Annalena and me are right now with the Deutsche Wohnen and Eignen referendum we had like some years back. But there are more initiatives in other countries. So I think that this is like really something which already achieved becoming one of the strongest priorities in the EU. And now we are starting a fight about what does that mean? Because, of course, the political right, conservatives, the far right, liberals have quite a different kind of approach when it comes to the housing crisis than the progressive side also in the parliament. So this is, of course, the debate which we are dealing with right now. But it's a priority. It's a common priority. And now we need to ensure that we are ending up with strong measures there, and like not just measures of deregulating the industry and the financial sector so that problems maybe are getting worse.
Leilani, do you have any, I'm sure you have any thoughts on this. What do you think about these developments?
I mean, it's a huge congratulations to the EU for these developments and for listening to people who've been making a lot of noise on the ground saying housing is this pressing issue. And I mean, I mean, of course, I followed the movements in Berlin and in Barcelona in particular, where rents were escalating. I mean, Berlin used to be one of the most affordable cities and really is no longer with that status. And, you know, the movements have been so inspiring, as have some of the politicians and members of European Parliament. So I think it's fantastic. And that there is now this housing committee and the commissioner, these are the steps that need to be taken. And I think for some of us, it feels like, oh, it's so slow. But I've been an advocate for almost 30 years now. Change, you know, you chip away. That's how you make change. And these institutional positions are very important for change, because not only can they result in change, they're a signifier of change and they give people hope. Okay. My regional government in Europe is listening. They're taking this seriously. But I also take Rasmus's point that it's very fragile, because different political parties have different understandings, diametrically different understandings of how to solve the housing crisis. And what really worries me that I see from, you know, central all the way into the right of most political parties is this continued belief that the market and market actors, unregulated, with no conditions, are going to produce what we need, that they're going to solve the crisis when they've created the crisis in the first place. It's very rare that you go to the very actors who have created a crisis, who are benefiting from a crisis, to ask them, without any changes to their behavior, without demanding anything different from them, that they solve the crisis. It absolutely doesn't make sense. And it's deeply troubling. But that's what you hear, right? You hear, oh, the problem is zoning laws. We should just forget about zoning laws. That's the real reason. We need to build, 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 keep building, building, without ever saying, well, there's this thing called a human right to housing that requires certain standards. Certain things have to be met. It's not about markets. It's about people. That you never hear that conversation from, you know, centrist politicians to the right. And so it is deeply worrying. And what worries me too is the corporate capture of many governments. And so many of these actors have a seat at political tables. This is what I mean about governments not leading, right? When COVID struck, who was going around consulting with governments about their economic and fiscal and monetary policies? BlackRock, not Blackstone, but BlackRock, which is a very big private equity company, right? So the corporate capture of governments is of real concern. And I'll just say one more thing, which is that I think that governments need to understand that human rights can be a real carrot for them. They can use human rights, and they actually must use human rights, to guide their interactions with these investors. They need to start asserting that they have, as governments, human rights obligations to fulfill, and that if they're going to hand over an area that's a human right, housing, to the private sector has to take on board the human rights obligations that the government has and has to be responsive to that. I'm going to give an example. When governments engage with these actors, they'll say often, oh, we want you to build affordable housing. And so the actors go, oh, okay, well, how do we make a profit? And I mean, that right there, the conversation is incorrect, right? So then what governments do is they'll negotiate. Okay, well, if you have a certain number of units that are 80% of market rent, we'll call that affordable because it's lower than market rent, or 60% of market rent. That it's a complete turnaround of the way housing should be viewed, right? Affordability under international human rights law is not tied to what markets can command. Affordability is based on income, household income, right? What can people afford? So affordability is defined under international law as, you know, having enough money at the end of the month after you pay your housing costs to feed your children, buy medicines if you need to, buy clothing, send your children to school, etc. Yeah? Groceries, food. So anyway, just to say that I think we need new conversations and new conversations between tenants, governments, and investors.
Well, you talked a lot about governments, and we heard a lot about what is going wrong. From your point, what can governments do? What is needed? Which steps are needed to solve this crisis and make affordable housing possible in Europe and maybe worldwide?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could say, you know, well, they should, you know, do this simple step or these three simple steps. I don't think it's that easy, actually. I think that most economies are very much entangled with real estate as a driver of economic growth. And most governments want their economy to grow. And they've been using the housing sector, the construction sector, the built environment as a vehicle for that. And they believe, even though it's not true because it's not productive capital, but they believe that investment in housing is part of that equation and an important part. So there's some untangling, I think, that has to be done. What I would like to see is for governments to commit to producing public value with public dollars. I think that would be a good start, because these actors get all sorts of tax breaks, preferential tax treatment, waivers of taxes, waivers of fees, etc. They get a lot of preferential treatment through our taxation system and through legislation. And so there is an approach that says, okay, maybe it's okay to have all of these waivers and exemptions, etc., but only if what we get from that as government is public good and public value and the human right to housing at the end. So that what that looks like is conditionality, for example, the idea that, you know, like real estate investment trusts, for example, which is one of the tools used to purchase apartment buildings. It's a financial entity. They generally do not pay income tax. I think they exist in 43 jurisdictions around the world, including throughout Europe, and they do not pay income tax. So one approach could be for governments to say, okay, we're not going to change that. We're going to continue to allow them to be exempt. However, we're going to ask something for that corporate handout. That's a corporate handout, right? And what we're going to ask is no rent evictions. For example, we're going to ask for less increases in rent, or we're going to impose stronger rental tenant protections, right? As a trade-off for those benefits. That's one approach. That's a very mild approach. It's not necessarily my preferred approach, mm-hmm. but it's a mild approach that doesn't upset things and that could be done quite quickly. But I just think if governments could think to themselves, am I getting public value for the dollars that we are giving out, right? What public value am I getting in the area of housing? Am I keeping people housed with these dollars? Am I making people more secure in their tenure? Am I ensuring fewer people fall into homelessness? I think those are good questions for governments to ask, mm-hmm. a starting point.
Rasmus, do you have anything to add?
Well, I think that the points are already being made, and I fully agree, because in general terms, I think it will be important to organize housing, publicly much more than like what we can see is going on right now. I think that this means we need a lot of different kind of measures. We need more public investments. We need clear definitions on what affordable housing or social housing actually means. There is, for example, in the EU, no common definition about this, meaning you could end up also supporting with public money, maybe housing projects for people who maybe don't need public support. And on the other side, we are not doing enough to support housing projects for low-income people, for example. But I also think that we in general need rules for the financial markets also to limit speculation with housing. And there I think we really didn't do a lot in the past 20 or 30 years, also not at the European level. And this, I think, we need to change, for example, by implementing a so-called profit cap. We worked on a lot with a German NGO called Finanzwende, who actually wants to rebuild financial markets for the public good. Let's put it like that. And they developed like a concept called profit cap, so that that the big real estate companies not can pay their shareholders a lot of dividends, and then because we then don't have the money to reinvest in the housing sector, for example, to ensure stable rents or to ensure that like buildings will be modernized to an affordable price. So this is something I think where we could do some very concrete measures, also at European level, but also on a national level in Europe, with a big impact for a lot of people, and who would change not just the conversation, but also the way the ways we are dealing with when it comes to housing. So this, I think, is really important. But I just want to add one more aspect, just because I started out by saying a bit earlier in our conversation today that we are a lot talking about big cities, and I also mentioned Berlin, other big cities. But I mean, this is not just true for big cities, right? This is true for all of us. And also in smaller, medium-sized cities, we can see some of the same problems already coming up, because the big companies, real estate companies, for example, are also getting more and more interested like in smaller cities, because they are already having a lot of power like in the bigger cities. We did a poll about the biggest like social concerns people in Germany have, and we did the poll in a way so that we could see all differences between big cities, smaller cities, different regions in Germany. And what I found quite interesting is that also more in rural areas, like the one I'm from, like in Schleswig-Holstein, rural area close to the Danish border, people's biggest concern is about speculation on the housing sector and on healthcare. That's the situation, on health as well, but also on housing. So this is like really also a pressing issue, not just for people in Hamburg or in Berlin or in Barcelona, but also in the rural areas. And I think this is really an important point. We can put the link to the polls also in the show notes of the episode, so everybody can have a look. But I just wanted to mention this, because I think sometimes this is misunderstood also in the broader debate in the parliament, that conservatives are saying, yeah, but this is a problem in the bigger cities and you need to deal with that in the bigger cities. And we can see that, but most of the people in Germany are not living in the bigger cities, but in smaller cities, and for them it's not a big issue. But that's a simple not true. And I think that that we really need to be aware of that the problem is getting bigger and bigger, and more people are concerned, even if they are not living in cities like Munich, Hamburg, or Berlin.
It's just quicker in bigger cities, because there is more movement.
Yeah, sure.
Leilani, it's a pity that our listeners can't see you, because you're so actively reacting to what Rasmus is saying, and you see so much passion, and you can see the way you're thinking, you're connecting dots, and you have so many talking points right now. I can see you writing. It's crazy. But we are heading to 45 minutes, which is our limit. But I want to give you the chance to react to that, and also to like give some last words to our listeners.
Sure. I think what Rasmus just said is so important, because that's what I'm seeing as well globally. It is small cities as much as big cities, it's rural as much as urban. And that is the thing about financialization. It's not about buying the coolest building in the grooviest neighborhood or the next up and coming neighborhood. No, no. They see ways to make money and increase the valuation of property everywhere. And so no one is exempt from this, and it must be addressed. I do want to say one thing. I think people often critique me, which is probably something I need to take on board about the way I speak about financialization. I think some people think I don't think there should be investment in social housing, and that, you know, if we fix financialization, we're fine. It's not that at all. I absolutely think there has been underinvestment in social housing. I am shocked, actually. I didn't know there was not a common definition of social housing across the EU. So that's really interesting and obviously something to be worked on. But obviously, there has been an underinvestment in social housing. What I feel is there are a lot of groups already working on pushing governments for more social housing. There are far fewer advocacy groups doing what Rasmus said, which is trying to tackle financial markets and taming them and getting them to adhere to human rights. And so I am one person with an abundance of energy, but limited energy and time. And so if I'm going to focus, then my expertise really is on these financial actors. And so that's where I put my energy. But just to say, of course, we need more social infrastructure and social housing. And lastly, I love this idea of a profit cap. I was just talking about this with a colleague yesterday, that in London, in the city of London, there used to be profit caps on developments of properties. And after a certain level of profit was made, any extra profits had to go back into the coffers of the City of London to be used for public good. And I don't know that that's exactly what you were talking about, Rasmus, but we have to start having that kind of conversation. When have you recently heard the term profit cap? You know, are they talking about that at Davos? You know, these are dirty words still, and we have to start making them really popular ideas. So I think I'll just end there to say, I think we're on a road. And I think the EU is on a road, having appointed the new commissioner and the new committee. But there's a lot of work to be done. And things can so easily not be progressive if we don't keep pushing. And as I've said, and as I'll keep saying, using human rights as a carrot, providing us with the standards that need to be met around security of tenure, affordability, dignified housing that's habitable as we experience climate change, especially that's cool in the summers and warm in these cold winters.
Thank you so much for taking the time, Leila, and it was a pleasure having you here.
It's been a total pleasure. What an animated conversation. And now I'm going to have Rasmus on my podcast.
that's a good idea. We can do that.
I would love that.
Thanks so much.
We're going to provide everybody with a link to that podcast.
That's great.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you so much.
Goodbye. Thank you so much.
Do you also feel like you want to walk out that door and solve the housing crisis right now with your own hands?
For sure. Yeah. But I also think I also still have a lot in mind. I just want to write down and do some notes and try to start like thinking about what to do and also how to maybe also follow up also with her, because I think she's quite inspiring and she has a lot of knowledge we can use also for the European debate.
She's so energetic and so passionate. And she wouldn't have needed us in any way to talk about this topic.
That's true.
You tip on hers and so you say housing crisis and she's exploding with energy and ideas and describing her problems. And it's wonderful.
Yeah.
A very, very, very nice guest. I'm so happy that we had her.
I fully agree. And for me, there were also some aspects I'm thinking I need to think a little bit more about, but also maybe on topics where I agree with her, like on the substance, but where I got a new angle to this. For example, she said that there are a lot of big US corporations owning a lot of housing stocks in Europe, and I mean, right now also with the election of Donald Trump, we are debating a lot on European sovereignty and how to ensure that Europe can act and we are not dependent on the US and others. And this is about security and about maybe also competition of companies, but not so much about the housing sector. But I also think that, like, yeah, the problem is not getting any different because of that, but it gives a new angle also to the debate. And I think this sometimes also can be important to get more support also, for example, from other political parties to solve some of those issues. So that I found was quite interesting as well.
Yeah, I really like that those interviews are also shaping like your political view. That's pretty nice. Next week, we're going to talk to Sophie Pornschlegel, Director of Studies and Development at Europe Jacques Delors. We're talking about the rise of the far right in Europe and what this does to the European Union, politics and democracy.
Die große Gefahr ist eben, dass wir schon sehen, dass Länder wie China und Russland und wahrscheinlich auch die USA mit Trump schon versuchen, Europa zu schwächen, zu fragmentieren. Also sie stärken praktisch die Rechten in Europa und haben dadurch schon auch wirklich einen Einfluss auf unsere eigenen Demokratien. Und das ist sehr komplex, finde ich, und sollte uns viele Sorgen bereiten, tatsächlich.
Okay, let's wrap this up. We are very happy if you talk to us, especially if you talk to Rasmus about your questions or topics you would like to hear us talk about, any guests you would like to see on this podcast. And you can reach out to Rasmus via Instagram or via voice messages via the website. And you will find all the links in the show notes.
If you like the podcast, then you can rate us on different platforms with 5 stars. We would love to get your support.
Yes, and don't forget to subscribe the podcast so that you will get an update about our next episodes.
Money Matters ist ein Podcast von und mit Rasmus Andresen, Abgeordneter der Grünen im Europaparlament. Produziert von Bosepark Productions.